John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for February 23rd through March 1st, 2013. Palestinian delegation discusses in the U.S. the upcoming visit of the American President Barack Obama to the Middle East. Meanwhile, Palestinians take to the streets in protest of the death of Palestinian prisoner in Israeli jails. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report with the non-violent activities organized in the West Bank. This week, 12 Palestinians were injured when Israeli troops attacked the weekly anti-wall and settlement protests organized at a number of West Bank communities. I am EMC's Salam Kumsiya with the story.
One Palestinian youth was injured and four arrested, among them an international supporter, as Israeli troops attacked the weekly protest at the village of Kfar Kadum in northern West Bank. Israeli troops attacked the protest as soon as it reached the village entrance that was blocked by the army 10 years ago. Soldiers used tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. Sharaf Ishtewi, 23, was injured in the head when troops hit them with rifle butts. He was taken to a nearby hospital for treatment. In central West Bank, anti-war protests were organized at the villages of Bil'in, Na'lin, and Nabi Saleh. The residents and their international supporters managed to reach the Israeli wall at the villages of Bil'in and Na'lin before soldiers attacked them with tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. And Nabi Saleh protesters were attacked by Israeli troops before they even left their village. Six residents were injured in Nabi Saleh, among them two children, while another four civilians, among them one international supporter, were injured at the village of Bil'in. Many others were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation at all three locations, local resources reported. Also on Friday, anti-wall protests were organized at Al-Ma'sara village near Bethlehem and in Hebron Old City, southern West Bank. Israeli soldiers attacked Al-Ma'sara villagers and their supporters using rifle butts and batons and forced them back into the village. While at Ash-Shuhada Street in Hebron Old City, troops used tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets to attack unarmed protesters. One Palestinian youth was injured in the head, and many others suffered effects of tear gas inhalation. Ash-Shuhada Street was closed for Palestinians by the Israeli army 13 years ago to provide so-called security for illegal Israeli settlements inside the old city of Hebron. For IMEMC News, this is Salam Qumsiyah.
In Washington, a high-ranking Palestinian delegation discussed with U.S. officials an upcoming visit for the U.S. President Barack Obama to the Middle East, including a visit to Palestine. This comes as Israel has slowed down the illegal construction of settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. IMEMC's Rami Al-Maghari with the details.
Top Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat, along with other PA officials, paid a visit to Washington in preparation for the expected visit of U.S. President Barack Obama to the region, including the occupied Palestinian territories. Erekat maintained that the discussions tackled a number of Palestinian concerns, mainly the need to push a stalled peace process forward based on the two-state solution, and that the PA is committed to a previous position that Israel should halt all illegal settlement activities before any peace talks are resumed. Some political commentators believe that the visit will not bring much momentum to the peace process until the U.S. is heavily involved and practices some more pressure on Israel. A number of local media outlets reported this week that the PA could consider returning back to negotiations table should Israel release thousands of Palestinian prisoners from the jails. This week, Israel urged the Palestinian Authority to prevent likelihood of a third Palestinian uprising in light of a mysterious death of one of those prisoners from the West Bank city of Hebron. Israel released tax funds due to the Palestinian Authority. At the internal Palestinian level, both Fatah Party of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and the Islamist Hamas Party are yet to agree on national unity, as talks between the two sides have been deadlocked recently. For IMEMC News, I am Rami Al-Maghari in Gaza.
This week witnessed clashes every day between Israeli troops and Palestinian youth protesting in solidarity with Palestinian political detainees held by Israel on hunger strike. The clashes escalated when a political detainee died in army detention due to torture. Around 150 Palestinians were reported injured by Israeli troops' gunfire. IMEMC's Ghassan Manoura has more.
Thousands gathered at the town of Sa'ir near the southern West Bank city of Hebron on Monday of this week and marched in the funeral of Arafat Jaradat, who died on Saturday while being held by the Israeli army in Rimon detention center. The Israeli army said that he died due to cardiac arrest. Jaradat's family said that he never suffered from any heart problems, while a Palestinian doctor sent by the Palestinian Political Prisoners Affairs Ministry said Jaradat's body showed signs of torture and that what killed him. Majdi Al-Adra is a spokesperson from the Palestinian Ministry for Political Prisoners Affairs.
The member of the medical autopsy sent by our minister, Dr. Saber Al-Alu, concluded in his report that Arafat's heart did not suffer from cardiac arrest, and he has also said that there are marks of torture on his neck and his left shoulder, and that his second and third left ribs are broken and there are severe marks on his left side of his abdomen, and a contusion on his back that goes 9 centimeters inwards.
Moreover, this week, another 7 Palestinian political prisoners entered the open-ended hunger strike in protest of Jaradat's death and the Israeli ill-treatment of Palestinian political detainees. This raised the number of hunger-striking detainees to 11. The longest in the hunger strike is Samer Al-Isawi, who is in hunger strike since 7 months. Murad Jaradat is from Ad-Damir Association for Prisoner Support and Human Rights.
The protests by the political detainees against this crime are likely to escalate because this year we have witnessed the death of 2 political prisoners, one in January, and in February we lost Arafat Jaradat. This raises the death toll of the political detainees to 203 martyrs.
According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 150 Palestinians were injured this week during solidarity protests with Palestinian political detainees organized across the West Bank. In Bethlehem, one youth was shot in the head and is in critical condition. Moreover, the Israeli army this week conducted at least 51 military invasions into West Bank communities and arrested at least 36 Palestinians, including 23 children. Elsewhere in the Gaza Strip this week, the Israeli army attacked Palestinian fishing boats 7 times. Damage was reported to fishing boats, and one fisherman was slightly injured during one of the attacks the army did on Monday of this week. For IMEMC News, this is Ghassan Bannoura.
And that's all for today from This Week in Palestine. This was the weekly report for February 23rd through March 1st, 2013. Occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please keep visiting our website www.imemcu.org. The report has been brought to you by Hassan Tassis and me, George Rishmal.
Controversy erupted on the Yale University campus in late January when the Yale Herald newspaper reported that the Pentagon Special Operations Command had recently awarded Charles Morgan, a professor of psychiatry at Yale's medical school, a $1.8 million grant to teach interviewing methods to U.S. Army Green Berets using New Haven's local immigrant population as volunteer paid test subjects. The objective of the Center for Excellence for Operational Neuroscience that Morgan hoped to direct is to improve the quality of military intelligence that will be applied by the Pentagon in the field and in combat zones around the world. Yale students, faculty, community, and immigrants' rights groups quickly mobilized opposition to the military research project, objecting to the militarization of the Yale campus and what they viewed as ethically suspect interrogation training that would target local immigrants. By February 22nd, a student online petition against the training center had garnered more than 650 signatures with planned protests. But as opposition surfaced, the Department of Defense retracted an earlier statement that confirmed it was providing Yale funds for the center, declaring that the Pentagon has not and will not provide Yale funds to establish Morgan's research project. Robert J. Alpern, Dean of Yale Medical School, issued a press release stating, "We are not moving forward on any such center until we have fully investigated all these issues." Your reporter spoke with Chris Hebdon, a doctoral student in anthropology at Yale, who discusses the current status of the research center and why student, faculty, and community groups came together to challenge the ethics of military research on campus.
There were some of us who were interested in organizing discussions about drone bombings, and we were in touch with each other, and I got involved by talking with a student in the French department and an undergraduate at Yale College who wrote an op-ed in the Daily News and tried to connect with immigrant activists in New Haven to rally around this issue.
I'll just quote from a statement released by Yale School of Medicine Dean Robert Alpern that was published last week. "Members of the Yale and New Haven communities have raised concerns about a possible Center for Operational Neuroscience that was reported in the press. In light of the issues raised, we are not moving forward on any such center until we have fully investigated all these issues." Now, until we have fully investigated all these issues, sounds like this program may very well be still alive and well.
Yeah, there was a lot of ambiguity in what the university said and also what the military said. The short history of it is that when we wrote to the Pentagon, they confirmed that such a grant was initiated and so forth. And we talked to the university, and they said that this research was under review and that it was going to be, you know, held according to all the strict standards of Yale's research protocols. But within 24 hours, we heard from the military that no grant had ever been given and that no grant would be given. And 24 hours later, we heard again from the military that this grant was denied in 2012, a year ago. And Yale, yes, has said that no such thing will proceed until a proper, you know, investigation of it or review has been done. But they certainly haven't been clear. I think what's really important, though, is that even if this program doesn't proceed at Yale, who's to say it's not going to take place at another university that is more broke or needs the money? So I think that's the reason to keep up discussion and get some open debate at Yale, also at other universities, and with the wider New Haven community.
Chris, it's certainly true that there are many military-funded research projects on the Yale campus itself and across the country. What do you know about other military-funded experiments and research going on that may be below the radar and, you know, as objectionable as this one? Or is there some kind of policy on campus that would enable students, the faculty, and the New Haven community at large to gain some transparency into these programs to better know what's being done on the campus?
There's no formal procedures. So if a biologist submits something for National Science Foundation, once a proposal is approved, it becomes public. Same thing for NIH, for example, publicly funded research. DOD is also publicly funded, but it is not made available even after it's approved. So under the radar is exactly the right statement. This is something that apparently we wouldn't have known about. I mean, this operational special ops center was slated to open in just a month or two, and we hadn't heard anything about it. And the issue of militarization in universities, but also issues of militarization in the United States, are general. It's not just at Yale. So you have CIA-funded centers for intelligence studies and national security studies. You see this at places like University of Maryland, University of Washington, lots of other schools. And these types of programs highlight the problems with the difference of priorities between academic and foreign policy goals. So national security studies is not an academic field. It's a military objective and a political objective. And so I think that this is why we need a debate with the community, in the media, with professors and students who really bring this stuff out in the open. Yale has a long history of involvement with the military and continues right through to today. You know, we have Stanley McChrystal teaching classes here for the last couple of years in the Jackson Institute of Global Affairs. And this was also very controversial and highlights the problems with academia and military involvement, which is that his students were not allowed to take their notes out of class and talk about them. So there's secrecy. And that's very antithetical to the liberal arts university, but to open inquiry in any university. And we're hoping to get more people around the United States, and especially in New Haven, talking about these things.
That was Chris Hebdon, a doctoral student in anthropology at Yale University. Find more information and discussion on military research in academia on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Breaking news, alleged WikiLeaks source Bradley Manning has pleaded not guilty to aiding the enemy, but guilty to 10 lesser charges in a military court. He also said the Washington Post and the New York Times refused his information, so he had to send it to WikiLeaks. Meanwhile, a CIA employee who blew the whistle on a Bush-era torture begins serving a 2.5-year prison sentence today, while the torturers he blew the whistle on walk free. Bradley Manning had to wait until today just to enter his plea after being arrested in Iraq in 2010,
held without charges for about a year, and tortured at Quantico Marine Barracks. On the last night of November, anarchists in Vancouver, Canada, burned down a bank in solidarity with the remaining anarchists held in a Seattle jail for refusing to snitch out other anarchists to a Seattle grand jury. The grand jury has been holding a witch hunt into anarchists and Occupy activists in Seattle and the surrounding areas. Earlier that day, anarchists Matt Duran and Kedio had been released after a judge ruled that their refusal to snitch for 5 months in custody meant further confinement was punitive rather than coercive. Still in jail is anarchist Maddie Pfeiffer, and Vancouver anarchists took things to the next level by burning down a bank. Here is a communique they published on www.anarchistnews.org. Quote, "The fire still burns. With the news of the release of two of the three grand jury resistors warmed our hearts, but also filled them with anger. The state has taken parts of their life they will never get back. We also have not forgotten about the third resistor, Maddie, and all of the other nameless ones. So last night, we decided to send a message that the release of our comrades will not stop our attacks on financial infrastructure, government, and all others who oppress and take away our freedom. An unsuspecting bank, CIBC, had a Molotov cocktail thrown at it. The flames brought new life to our minds and destruction to the bank and a sense of insecurity to the Vancouver police and the bank's investors that they will never be able to stop us and that our attacks will increase. The fire will always burn. Last night, we let that fire burn a financial institution that profits off the lives of the workers and the foreclosures of families' homes. Let this inspire anarchists and other radical elements of Vancouver, Coast Salish territory, to attack and to attack now. We cannot be stopped. Love to all comrades from CST Vancouver." That ends the communique on anarchist news for the burning of a bank in Vancouver, Canada, in solidarity with Pacific West Coast grand jury resistors. On the 27th of February, an activist with tar sands blockade locked his neck to the screen used for a Trans-Canada presentation at an oil company shindig. Ethan Nuss went face-to-face with Paul Miller, who is Trans-Canada's Executive Vice President of Oil Pipelines. This in front of a whole ballroom full of tar sands industry investors. Here's what things sounded like as Ethan Nuss put the screws to Trans-Canada.
Oceana continue to resist the fossil fuel infrastructure that poisons low-income communities of color disproportionately more than anything else. I, my conscience, will no longer allow this madness to continue, knowing what we know about climate change and the chaos that's coming to our communities. I,
how did you get here?
Help me to act.
I bet
Paul
you
Miller,
know.
We have a message for you to bring back to all
I
your
bet you need Doyle to get here. If you
want. No longer will we allow business as usual. I've done everything I can to stop
you from
the pipeline. I've protested. I've signed petitions. I've stood in line. I've testified at public hearings. Nothing else.
Okay, everybody, folks.
Today
I would like to say, why don't we all take a break and go on? Okay, thank you. We have a police officer here who will take this man into custody and arrest him. So I apologize for all this, but why don't you take your break and we will reconvene. And I want to apologize also to Mr. Miller and Ms. Allen. Thank you very much.
This speech was enough to drive the oil industry barons from the room, but he kept going so they could not come back. It took over an hour for security forces to remove the lock Ethan used to secure himself to the movie screen, yet he was out of jail by 8 p.m. that night. Here's what he had to say about this action.
I'm taking action because I have a moral responsibility to confront the climate crisis and the extractive energy industry head on. I've seen too many communities poisoned and destroyed by extractive industries, and too often low-income and communities of color are those who are hardest hit by these polluting industries. And to put all of the corporate profiteers who are making money off of our pain and suffering on notice that there is a growing movement across this country and across the world who will no longer allow business as usual to poison our communities.
Meanwhile, other protesters were stepping it up outside. These folks are not fooling around. TransCanada, you have just been put on notice. You have no place to run and no place to hide. As Ethan said, your conferences and events will be found, pursued, and disrupted wherever they take place. Already, investors and contractors are being hounded. Before this is over, TransCanada and the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline are going to be the Huntington Life Sciences of oil, a Flying Dutchman welcoming no bank, no insurance company, and no building.
Leaders of Native nations in both Canada and Oklahoma from the U.S. were among the speakers at the Forward on Climate rally in Washington, D.C. on February 17th, which saw an estimated 35 to nearly 50,000 people come together to demand that President Obama deny a federal permit for construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. The pipeline would transport dirty tar sands from Alberta, Canada, to refineries on the Texas Gulf Coast, mostly for export. The southern leg of the pipeline, already under construction in Texas, has generated powerful local opposition through groups such as the Tar Sands Blockade. Tar sands have a much bigger carbon footprint than other fossil fuels. Groups like the Sierra Club and 350.org, main sponsors of the Washington protest rally, have been calling on Mr. Obama to live up to his post-election pledges to tackle climate change and nix this project. One of the Native leaders who spoke at the rally was Jackie Thomas, a chief of the Sea Coos First Nation in northern British Columbia. She is a co-leader of the Yinka Dene Alliance, a coalition of First Nations and others working to stop the proposed Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline from taking tar sands from Alberta through British Columbia to the Pacific Ocean for export. In this excerpt from her talk, she addresses the problems tar sands extraction has already caused and about the alliances that are growing in Canada and the U.S. to stop the tar sands pipeline projects.
I am a mother of four and a grandmother of one, and I was raised by my own grandmother. She was a traditional medicine woman of my people, and I learned early on the value of our environment. And what she told us was, when we take care of the land would take care of us. If we destroy this land, we will destroy ourselves. I'm speaking on behalf of the Yinka Dene Alliance. We formed an alliance to stop the Enbridge Northern Gateway Project, which plans to bring tar sands oil to the coast of British Columbia, which will then be put on tankers to go to the Asian markets. It puts at risk my neighbors to the east of me that live at the tar sands. The government doesn't recognize these people, and these people have been dying of mysterious cancers. Their water is polluted, their animals are sick, and Mother Earth is sick. Our alliance have used our own laws to protect our lands, and for centuries we've done this. We created the Save the Fraser Declaration. Currently we have over 135 First Nations in Canada signed up to this. We have built alliances and will be signing international documents with other nations of the indigenous world in the future. The Canadian government has been calling me an environmental extremist, a radical, and an enemy of Canada. All I want and my people want to do is protect this land and this water that is sacred. This water that we're talking about has no color. This water that we're talking about is not just water for my own people. It is water also for my neighbor ranchers, my neighbor farmers that live next door to me. It's a human issue, and it impacts everyone. We are all connected. Enbridge really has brought our communities together in Canada because we've had oil spills, and you've also had oil spills in this country because oil will spill. It's just a matter of when. They've spilt in the Kalamazoo. They've spilt oil in Red Deer, Alberta. They've spilt oil in my sister, the territories of the Lhuicon Cree. They've spilt oil in the Northwest Territories, the Dene brothers and sisters that I know from the Northwest Territories. And of course, who can forget Exxon Valdez? Never in my life have I ever seen white and Native work together until now. In Canada, First Nations are always expected to be the sacrificial lambs for our government in terms of the economy. Like the economy is a human being. Like the economy is more important than our land and our water. Water is a non-renewable resource, and we can't take it for granted. Under the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, the Inka Dene Alliance have not given our free, prior, and informed consent to this project. In Canada, there's a judicial review process going on right now. While the process is still underway, our government has made public statements to the effect that this project will go through. Over the last year, my country has made changes to environmental laws that eases the burden for industry to discriminately go forward with these projects. We cannot keep taking out of greed. We should only take out of need. I'm here to ask you and to ask the world to help us. The Canadian government has made it clear they will approve Enbridge. We need your help to stand with us. We need your prayers. I need somebody to stand with me as the bulldozers come. I'm laying down my life.
That was Chief Jackie Thomas of the Siku's First Nation in Canada. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Learn more about the issues related to tar sands extraction and the Keystone XL pipeline by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Everything's red. All red, everything. Everything's red. All red, everything. Everything's red. Everything's red. 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 Dead. Red. Dead. Red. First off, I send love to Lupe for giving us hope in this Lakota Sioux. All red, everything, red nation rising. Yeah. Revising our story, they're televising. Child of the plains, I see 2020. Yeah. Poverty porn, TV pimpers for money. Nah. Tell Diane Sawyer, I am a warrior. Yeah. Give me your camera, send pal to your lawyer. Free all my people, get them out of prison. Yeah. Take them to Sundance, show them how we're living. Right. Give youth an outlet, disadvantaged prodigies. Feed these Republicans all our commodities. Put them on the reds. From the day they're born.
one. They won't survive cause their cancer is airborne. Put them in our schools, put them in our shoes. Take away their money and give them our booze.
Red,
make everything red. Words of my ancestors up in my head. Food for thought, our kids underfed. Your oil is mud, they want the earth dead. Oil for blood, making you rich, you soil my love. Oil for blood, my mother is clean, that oil is mud. Keystone, everything's red. Pipeline, now everything's dead. Keystone, everything's red. Pipeline, now everything's dead.
Everything's red, everything's red. Red, 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 dead. Red, dead. Red.
I can't afford to leave the res. Government has got me trapped. The leadership need a tip, and most of my tribal leaders whack. They don't wanna hear that, they just wanna chill. I'm sick, I'll go to IHS and get a pill.
For real?
Like a song without a title,
yeah.
Feel forgotten, like slaves picking the cotton. Forever tribal, with no connection to the Bible. Flying, people rotting, sometimes I'm suicidal. Feeling like no exit, Generation X shit. Text mentioning sex, what I connect with. Technology, get this world to acknowledge me. My ancestors studied numbers and astrology. Like cult of philosophy, keep them haters off of me. Keystone XL, you smell like an atrocity. To my home and my ancestors, I'm loyal. Build that pipeline and I'm burning down your oil.
Oil for blood, oil for blood. Making you rich, you soil my love. Oil for blood, my mother is clean, that oil is mud. Keystone, everything's red. Pipeline, now everything's dead. Keystone, everything's red. Pipeline, now everything's dead. Everything's red, everything's red. Red, 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 dead. Red, dead. Red.
We have never stood by to see a whale die.
Is one whale's life worth war?
Until you find something worth dying for, we haven't really lived.
It looks like Sea Shepherd may have once again won this year's whale war in the Southern Ocean. As of the 1st of March, all ships in the whaling fleet have left the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary and crossed north of 60 degrees south. The Sun Laurel oil tanker, her lifeboat smashed by the Nishan Maru's collision with her, is being escorted by one Sea Shepherd ship as a safety precaution. Sea Shepherd has informed the whalers that they are free to take on fuel for the trip home from the Sun Laurel now that they are north of 60 degrees south and it is legal to do so. Sea Shepherd estimates it would not be worth their while to attempt to return to the whale sanctuary as the Southern Hemisphere summer is ending and the weather is turning bad. It would take 2 days to refuel and 4 more to return to the whale sanctuary. They'd get only 1 week out of a failed 3-month season. Paul Watson estimates an 80% chance that the whalers will simply take on fuel and sail home. Now for the score. Sea Shepherd can only confirm that 2 whales were killed out of the whalers' self-imposed quota of 900. 2 of the 3 harpoon ships were with Sea Shepherd ships the whole season and could not whale. It is possible that the Nishan Maru and Yushan Maru No. 2 may have killed whales during 2 days in which they had temporarily escaped, but not very many. Paul Watson estimates the whalers cannot have killed more than 75 whales at worst, less than a tenth of the number they had intended to kill, and the worst season the whalers have ever had in their entire history.